Group meeting, Friday, 2nd November, 1984. We all know how the Buddha presented suffering in his day, as birth, old age, decay, death, to be associated with those one dislikes, not to be associated with those whom one likes, and so on. They're just the ordinary things of life. And it is a fact that in his day, there was a very harsh legal system. The punishments meted out to criminals were something awful, really awful. And yet, 25 centuries ago, what prevailed then seems rather little, insignificant almost, compared with what is happening in the world today. It looks as if the worst aspect of human nature, I say human, actually I should say of subhuman nature, has sort of burst forth ever since the last war. It started perhaps with the horrible cruelties of the Nazi system and the what were they called, the camps, the
concentration
camps and so on, you see. Started with all that. And right in our own time, our very own time, the last few years, there is, for instance, the unceasing war between Iraq and Iran, and the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, glorifies sacrificing life and shedding rivers of blood for the sake of Islam. Add to that all the utterly unsocial, horrible things that go on. These senseless, cowardly murders, not only from the IRA, but from in various other parts of the world, and for various other reasons too. These indicate that the what is commonly called the human race is going through a period of very serious moral and spiritual illness. And if this illness passes some critical point or other, which I don't know what that point would be like, but if it passes that point, we are in danger of exterminating ourselves. It could also happen by accident, so to say. Somehow or other, without the intention to do wrong, somebody might press the wrong button somewhere, somewhen, and lo and behold, all the human race is really in danger. Today, nobody can tamper with nuclear power against a so-called enemy, because the consequences of that use would destroy the user also. There is no getting away from that. We had an example on a small scale after the First World War, when poison gas, chlorine particularly, and mustard gas was used. Mustard gas was invented by Sir William Pope, who was one of my chemistry lecturers in Cambridge. And in the chemistry courses which he took, organic chemistry, that is the chemistry of the compounds which contain carbon, he would explain how mustard gas was made. And having worked out the process and put down all the equations on the board, he would say with a really sad and wry smile, "That is poison, that is mustard gas." Now, of course, we thought that was terrible. And so the use of poison, chemical poisons for war, were abjured by both sides. But far, far more terrible than the effect of chemical poisons is the effect of the misuse of nuclear energy. Our task is to refrain completely from the misuse of such a power, because it would unquestionably destroy all human life and probably all life on the globe. Now, the great thing is we must never be frightened about this. Never mind me, but what will happen to my children, and so forth, and so forth. You see? Because in a state of fear, one can never see clearly what is the best thing that could be done. And of course, the best thing that could be done is indeed the most difficult thing of all. We have to be well aware of the fact that what we think and feel and speak and do is continuously affecting not only ourselves, but the whole world. We know the meaning of the word atmosphere in connection, of course, with the air that we breathe. And we know how that atmosphere can get polluted and cause some illness and so forth. But that is to an extent which is rather small compared to the poisoning of another atmosphere, which of course ordinarily people are unaware of or do not take any notice of, and that is the psychical atmosphere. Thought and feeling definitely affects this psychical atmosphere. There is a reality in the psychical atmosphere. We all know from our own experience how sometimes when we enter a room, we become aware of the kind of atmosphere, as we call it, that is prevailing in that room. It may be one of gloom, or it may be one of anxiety, or it may be one of jubilation. All that is something which every one of us can feel and sense. Now, what we are not sufficiently awake to is that each human being is responsible for injecting into the psychical atmosphere all the influences of his thought and feeling, and so forth. The world population as a whole, it's over 4,000 million already, is very ignorant of each, on the part of each person, of the influence that he is exercising in the world's psychical atmosphere. And this continuously affects us. It is somewhat similar to the effect of the physical atmosphere. When the atmosphere gets polluted, somebody is responsible for the polluting, the factory and those who work in the factory, or this, that and the other. They are responsible for the polluting. But it is not merely those who are responsible for the polluting who suffer the consequences of it. The whole population of that town or village or country or whatever it is suffers the result. It's the same with the psychical atmosphere, only to a worse degree. That is to say, worse not in so far as its physical extent is concerned, but in so far as it blinds us to our own individual responsibility regarding what we are contributing to that atmosphere. When we hear about the state of the world and so forth, we get an anxiety state in which we say, well, what do we do about it? But what we do about it, the most effective thing that we do about it, is something which most people do not do and are not prepared to do. As I said a little earlier, each one of us is responsible for the world condition. So, our own desires, our ambitions, the way we approach our physical condition, material condition and life, our family, our home, our town or whatever it is, the way we approach that is something which seems to each one of us that it is just beyond our power to do anything. Up to a point it is true that it is beyond our power, because the troublesome, the energy which is liberated, which is troublesome, is so vast, so great, that we feel helpless against it. Whenever we are moved by the urge to do something to help the situation, our particular environment, and if you like, the world situation, whenever we feel that urge, we feel associated with it a tremendous sense of helplessness. What can I, an ordinary man with limited faculties, limited resources, do to help in this situation? But the best thing we can do is to change ourselves. We must never forget that, because that is one of the real essential aspects of religious living, which means human living in the fully human sense. And then we ask the question, well, how shall I change myself? Which direction shall I move, etc., etc.? Now, those questions are the wrong questions. Because each person is a self-responsible individual. He is a free individual inside himself. He doesn't know the extent of his freedom. And people all over the world struggle for a for an ill-defined freedom. Their ill-defined freedom can be put in a single sentence: I can do what I like. That precisely is the error. Consider that sentence: I do what I like. The I in the sentence refers to oneself as a separate, isolated individual with his own separate, isolated ideas, beliefs, impulses, wishes, and so on. Now, the fact is that 4,000 million people are like that. So now, and no two people will have the identical urge or impulse or whatever it is. No two people will be alike that way. So they are all different impulses. Look at the impulses which move people to commit these horrible crimes of murder and so on all over the world. They are impulses which are utterly subhuman, and their methods are terribly inhuman. We can alter ourselves by becoming clearly aware of what is going on in our own waking state all day long. We have to be self-observant to the fullest degree. Something happens and we get angry, we'll say. All right? Don't let us fight against that anger, because we'll be fighting against ourselves. Let us consider that anger. Look at it and see. Yes, I am angry. Why am I angry? Because so-and-so has done this or said this or behaved like that, and therefore I feel anger, you see. But does my anger help either me or the other person? It doesn't in the least. In fact, it harms me. It produces an excessive flow of adrenaline in the system and drives me to violent action afterwards. And this is something which people just will not look at. People in the mass, they will not look at it. But people in the mass will look at it, will begin to look at it, when each one of us as an individual keeps looking at it. Because if, for instance, I look at my own psychological process as it occurs in the moment, and I see its true nature, and that, this is harmful, unnecessary, really, then my seeing that affects the psychical atmosphere of other people. Of course, somebody will say, that is a fanciful notion on your part. What influence can your idea have upon somebody else? Well, I won't argue the situation, because there's no point in arguing it. One has to see for oneself the fact as the fact. And if one is observant, one will see that this is true. One is constantly affecting others all the time, and others are affecting oneself. You see? Take a simple and almost absurd example. Mother with two or three little children between, say, a year or so and 3 or 4 years, you see. And of course, mothers suffer a lot from sleeplessness. I know Sylvia, for instance, didn't know sleep for 3 years after our first son was born, because the second one followed in 14 months. And of course, she never had any proper sleep for 3 whole years, practically. I also missed sleep for quite a while, you see, and so forth. And, well, in the ordinary way, educated people, cultured people, self-responsible people can control themselves. But the average woman or mother or father will stoop to violence against the child, you see. And every act of violence produces in the subconscious of that child a stored up revenge feeling to hit back. This is due to the activity of the reptilian part of our brain. It is the reptilian, the animal part of our brain, the purely animal, the derived from 400 million years ago, that is very responsive to the psychical atmosphere and to physical experience, which will be the stimulus to bring up that psychical atmosphere, you see. And so the person grows up with aggressiveness, fear, and all such things inside him. He can't help it. So now, if we will observe ourselves, really observe dispassionately, that is the important thing, and free of fixed criteria. This is evil, this is good. We don't really know what is evil and what is good on the whole. We have a certain idea, a general idea, and a general feeling about these things. And in some cases, people who are good people, as we call them in the world, they are very sensitive, of course. But they are very few. The mass of human beings have to grow in sensitivity this way. And we can help each other by ourselves doing the right thing. So don't have a positive, fixed idea of what is good and what is evil. Observe and see. Because after all, these reactions which we commonly call evil, are natural reactions. They are natural because we are descended from primordial ancestors who had all these elements in them. That is to say, the physical organism, which is a psychophysical organism, is descended from them. The animals are also psychophysical creatures. They have psyche. They haven't got psyche as far as the intellectual side of life is concerned. That is specific to us with our brains, the way our brains have grown. And our brains are what they are today only during the last 40,000 or 45,000 years. But we started evolving 45 million years ago. And we are the sort of final product today. And how far have we displayed the right fruit of that evolution? We see the state of the world, we see our own state and our own psychological process, and I'm afraid we can't give high marks for humanness and humanity in ourselves. So, the way to tackle the world problem is to tackle the individual problem, oneself. And oneself is the influence all the time upon one's environment, just as one's environment is the influence all the time upon oneself. There is a mutual interplay. The one upon the many, the totality, the many and the totality upon the one. It's an extraordinary thing. Now, you might wonder why I say this. Well, I say this for this very reason. The ordinary context of which we are aware is the context of the finite and the temporal. Space as a container of multitudinous, countless objects, things, persons, creatures, and so on, and phenomena. And we are conscious only in terms of separateness, isolativeness, and finitude. Similarly, with time, the past, the present, and the future, which is something which we anticipate. The future is not here at the moment. Every moment dies to give birth to the next moment. And that dies to give birth to the next moment. So we have our consciousness of time. Our sense of temporality is like that of a flowing stream. Stream in a pipe, so to say, or if you like, a river flowing along. But consciousness in terms of the finite and the temporal is a limited consciousness. The infinite and the eternal are the real context of transcendence itself, of the totality. The totality has its own context, which is the context of the infinite and the eternal. And man is, the evolution of man takes place in such a way that what we call mind ultimately can come to fruition in each person, each individual person. But when mind reaches out towards that culmination, that person is increasingly becoming conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. The eternal is not to be regarded as a perpetuation of a separate personality in forever and ever. That is a totally mistaken concept of eternity. You cannot, and in fact, it is almost impossible to have a concept of eternity. You can be conscious of eternity, you can be conscious of infinity, but you can never talk about it completely and fully. You see, all our language, all our thinking, which is only a stream of words actually, or pictures, and pictures are understood, are described as so many words again, you see, all that is in the limited sphere of the finite and the temporal. But consciousness grows and grows and grows until the limitations imposed by the finite and temporal are removed, and one does sense in your waking living state, you sense infinity and eternity. And as and when you sense it, you also wake up to the fact that it is utterly nondescript. It cannot be described. There are no concepts, no thoughts, no words which can formulate the infinite and the eternal. Not the words themselves, infinite, eternal. They contradict the finite and the temporal. If we were to talk in theistic terms, to talk about God is perfectly ridiculous. God is the untalkable subject, you see. But we can sense divinity, we can sense the totality, the supreme reality. It is only when we start describing God, God is this, that and the other, and God is not this, that and the other, that we make our mistake. Because if you examine every single presentation of God in language, you will see that it is just man projecting himself in terms of supreme, what he thinks is goodness. That is all. The man who says, God is love. What does that man mean by love? His own experience of love with his wife, with his friends, with his family, with his associates and so on. But that little something he transposes to a transcendent level and says, God is love. But then, if God is the totality, the creator, the ruler, the master of the totality, why present God as a man? Because all these words are human words, which apply to human beings. Do they apply to the transcendent? If God is the creator of the totality, in this totality we see tremendous cataclysms taking place, galaxies colliding and so forth. Our cosmos came into being because of a terrific explosion. But what exploded? That none of the scientists know or tell us or can tell us. We can talk about that some other day. Talk a little bit only, because whatever we say about these things is extremely limited. But the important point is that your consciousness, my consciousness, can free itself, become free of the limitations imposed by finitude and temporality, which means all our everyday life, in the manner in which we are aware of it, the limitations imposed by that will disappear, you see. And when consciousness really senses infinity and eternity, hate, anger, and evil of every sort has no place in that consciousness. Nevertheless, explosive things can happen, but they won't be seen as, I mean, explosive things in nature, for instance, happen, you see. They won't be seen as an evil. Today, if there's an earthquake and hundreds of people lose their lives and all the rest of it, you see, we say it was a terrible evil. But we don't say it's a terrible evil when galaxies collide. Do we? Why not? Our limited consciousness is incapable of taking in the vastness of the cosmic process. That is why we are insensitive to it. Now, if we talk of God as creator of the entire cosmos in which these galactic explosions take place, how do you think God, the God consciousness, views it? We can only talk in human terms. Can you see God saying, "Oh, another bubble has burst"? But God wouldn't think it was a terrible evil. If we are foolish enough to destroy ourselves and this planet with us, do you think God would be very concerned, or concerned at all? He'd say, "Oh, those stupid people, see what they've gone and done. Never mind, there are lots of asteroids now circling around the sun instead." I'll tell you a little story. My professor of experimental physics in Cambridge was Professor Searle. He was a really remarkable man. And one day he was attending to an experiment in physics which I was doing. It was an experiment in light. And suddenly a man, big, tall man, came in and said, "Sir, can you spare me a minute?" And of course, Professor Searle went off with him, came back after about 10 minutes. He said, "Sorry to have kept you waiting so long. Do you know who that was?" I said, "Yes, sir. That was Sir Ernest Rutherford." "Yes. Yes, you're right." Then a few moments later, after fiddling with the apparatus, he turned around on me and said again, "Do you know how the asteroids came into being?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Once upon a time, there was a planet, a large planet, between Mars and Jupiter. And on that planet, there was a physicist like Rutherford. He split the atom and psst." I can never imitate his psst. It was so strong. Could hear it right across the lab. All the asteroids came into being. Now, you know, that's a very interesting sort of experience which I had. It made me think a lot that here we humans can invent a story like that and laugh at it. Asteroids came into being. Well, perhaps the Lord God would also laugh if this planet Earth, Mother Earth, dear Mother Earth, suddenly became so many asteroids because I was stupid enough to misuse nuclear energy. So, I'm saying this because it is absolutely essential to remain calm and dispassionate inside ourselves. It's very difficult. Look at this phenomenon of what's happening in India as a result of Mrs. Gandhi's murder. This sudden upsurge of violence everywhere, and terrific violence. People talking of revenge as if it was right. You see, and so on. That is simply because human people are not yet able to be dispassionate and calm. If one is dispassionate, one is all inclusive. One includes everybody equally. And in that state of dispassionateness and inward calm, it is possible for love in its transcendent aspect to begin to manifest and flourish. This dispassionateness is not insensitivity or anything like that. It makes you more intensely sensitive to all that happens, the pleasant things, the unpleasant things, the good things, the evil things. And it is only when one is possessed of that kind of balance and self-control, not the control which is a forcible control, but a natural control, then one can do the greatest good for not only oneself, but also for one's whole environment.